what up? Welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball. All basketball, all the time, but we really tell personal stories. This week's guest is Langston Galloway of the Detroit Pistons. If you download and listen to this entire pod, don't forget to subscribe and rate. You'll learn where Langston Galloway was when he was called up to the Knicks from the Westchester Knicks. Pretty cool story. What it was like, not just his first game, took the train to his first game in D.C., but his second game was in the Garden against the Rockets, and he did pretty well. Plus, the feelings of signing a three-year guaranteed contract for over $20 million with the Detroit Pistons. We go into his background growing up in Baton Rouge, all the guys he used to play with and against growing up. Lots of good stuff. Can't wait for you to hear my interview with Langston Galloway. Let me start with the bubble. And look, what Paul George said is a real thing, not just because of the bubble. And we've talked about this in the pod before, which is it's not really natural to be in a hotel for 2 months, right? Not just if you're an NBA superstar, for anybody. You ever been stuck in a hotel? You're like, man, at some point, first, there's a moment there where it's really cool. You're like, man, I know the person at the front desk and the people that clean the room. I know every. And then there's a point where you're like, oh my gosh, I've become Groundhog Day, where it's the same thing over and over and over again. And you can say these are first world problems, but you have to also factor in that whatever your normal life is like, especially in the summer, hey man, I like to go fishing. I like to go on vacations. Like, now you're in this enclosed environment. You're still dealing with COVID and all the testing and everyone else going through the stresses of the playoffs, and you're kind of sequestered. However nice the resort is, it's still just a Disney resort. It does become Groundhog Day. I believe that Paul George was suffering from some form of kind of COVID-induced depression. Not that he had COVID, but all the other stuff with it. And then he broke out of it the other night, and it was amazing to see. And while Charles Barkley can say, like, hey, look, these are first world problems, he's right, but they're real problems. Real problems. If you have kids, you know, you probably have one that's gone through the same thing where suddenly they lack the motivation, where normally they're a get up and go kid. And now you're like, man, get up off the couch. Stop playing Fortnite. Stop texting your friends. Go out, be. Like, well, I can't be. I have to maintain social distancing. Like, you can ride your bike. You can go play hoops. You can go, you know, swim. You can do all these other things. Like, you can go and be around friends. And even after quarantine, there's still kind of some after effects. And I also think that that's part of what's factored in to all of the emotion with the NBA players based upon what's happened in Kenosha. Look, I respect your right to not just protest, but protest peacefully. That's what you're supposed to do. Let your stance be known. But at some point, we do, one, have to get back to work, which NBA players will. And two, we have to get to some sort of reasonable solutions. And not playing and boycotting not playing is not really a reasonable solution for anybody's business. Now, you can sit here and say, we have the power to not play, the power to cancel the season, but the TV rights holders also have the power to cancel their rights deals. There's something called a force majeure part of the contract. They can cancel it. And now all of a sudden your team falls into financial despair. And you can criticize owners and saying, we don't have your back. Or the owners are just saying, like, look, we have your back. On the other hand, we're operating a business and we're already losing money and we're hoping to recoup some of it with playoff money. If you choose to bail now, it's not just going to hurt us immediately not getting the playoff money. It's going to hurt us into the future, because then all of a sudden you got to, you know, your TV contracts come into question. Everything comes into question. How do you pay people for, you know, the Lakers have Spectrum Sports Net. How do you pay people if you don't have games to broadcast? You don't. And how can TV companies, how can your arenas, how can they have lease deals where they don't know if you're going to play on a given night? Like, that's you're a professional basketball player. This is part of professionalism. So it is absolutely players' rights to protest. I, like any human being with a soul, was bothered, disturbed even by what happened in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And you can stand in solidarity as an American citizen, like, hey, this is not how we want any of our citizens to be treated. But I do think it's time to get to some solutions, as we would all, I hope, agree that there's a problem.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Well, let's welcome him in from the Detroit Pistons. He's Langston Galloway. He's kind enough to join us here in the All Ball podcast. And I want to go back to the beginnings of, you know, your first days in basketball. Before we do that, like, what is this like for you where you're watching NBA teams train, play, now play in the playoffs, and you're like, and you're in the league, but it's like, wait, the league's going on and I'm not, it's gotta be, it's an interesting existence from my perspective. What's it like from your perspective?
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on. And, it's weird. It's weird. I guess you say from the sense of, it almost feels like I'm retired or something like that. It's like I'm watching basketball from a sense of outside looking in, but I'm still in. It's hard to explain, but it hasn't stopped me. It's actually been great for me because I've been just watching and just stealing little snips and pieces of different guys' game and trying to add it to my own while I'm working out and at home right now. So it's good. But like I said, I wish I was there in the bubble playing, but I'm actually getting more time with the family with my little 2-year-old. So it's been fun hanging out with him and getting this valuable time that I don't want to miss.
Yeah, no, I mean it's pretty amazing. I have friends that are in the bubble and they're like, man, this sucks. Family's not around, kind of isolated. Like, you know, you're home for 3 months with your family, which you would never get previously, you know, maybe never get again. So you try and have the perspective, and you're having the perspective of, yeah, like I want to be playing, but I'm getting this time, which you'll literally never get it back.
Yep.
Some of these offensive numbers are crazy. And I do feel like the rims are like Duke rims, right? They're super, super soft. But is it the officiating? Like, why is it? Because guys are only worried about basketball. Like, why do you think we have, like, Donovan Mitchell, Damian Lillard, Luka Doncic? Like, these guys are putting up obscene numbers. And look, we've seen some of that in regular seasons, but now we're talking about the playoffs, and usually defense has a tendency to dominate, and that's not nearly as much the case. Why do you think we've had these offensive explosions?
From my standpoint, and thinking back to when we were playing during the year, you got to think that we're traveling around year-round. Guys are kind of, not saying they're saving themselves, but guys are kind of cognizant of, like, man, we got a game in 2 days. We got to travel back to, you know, wherever and play. But now in the bubble, everybody's on the same playing field. It's no out elevation. It's no travel. It's literally like AAU ball. It brings you back to AAU ball and say, hey, look, let's go back, play AAU, go back to hotel, and then, hey, look, the next day or the day after, hey, let's play. Let's throw it up again. Let's play. So I think from that standpoint, that's why you're seeing so many explosions, because everybody's putting in the work. That's no question about that. Guys, I mean, went from 2 months off to back playing. Like, guys want to play. But at the same time, too, it's like, hey, why not go out there and give your best foot forward? Like, I mean, it's nothing that you need to hold back at this point, especially if you're going to be in the bubble for the next – I mean, you've been in the bubble for about a month and a half now. So if you want to stay in there as long as you can, I mean, hey, you might as well soak it all up and play your best basketball and show to the world that, hey, look, I'm here to stay. So I think it's a great opportunity for a lot of guys to showcase themselves, and that's what you're seeing. You're seeing all the young stars. They're really becoming stars.
You grew up in Louisiana. What was the first place you remember playing hoop?
Yeah, growing up in Baton Rouge, we had this facility called Sports Academy, and crazy to say, we've had almost 10 to 15 pros come out of this one gym, one like academy that everybody used to play in back in the day. I mean, you had guys like Big Baby, Marcus Thornton, Tyrus Thomas, Garrett Temple, myself. I mean, the list kind of goes on and on and on. That's just a list of guys from right now. And I remember us playing back in the day. Not saying I played with those guys because they're much older than I am, but just the competition. Like, they had co-ed games and they had different competition. I mean, they actually had, like, Simone Augustus. I mean, they had so many, like, just talented players that played in that league. And that was like, if you wanted to come out of Baton Rouge and get a chance to play at a high level, you had to go through Sports Academy. So that was key back in the day for myself and so many others.
Who is your rival? Like when I grew up in L.A., growing up, it was Ricky Price and Toby Bailey played on one team. We played against them. And Cameron Murray, who played at Louisville and USC, was on another team. And he played with the Lopez twins' brother was on a different team. Like we had rivals kind of growing up. Who was your like dude that you did battle with growing up at the Sports Academy?
You know what? We really, during my age group, there really wasn't that many guys that I battled with. But like I always played up. So like I would play against guys like it's kind of hard to say like in that group because there's a couple guys that played that didn't make it to the NBA, but they're overseas. A guy named Brian Williams, another guy, Markel Brown. I mean, those are just a couple guys that were from Louisiana area.
I know Markel. He went to Oklahoma State. Brian Williams we're talking about. There's a bunch of different. There was a Brian Williams who went to Alabama, but he's much older than you. I was a guard. That was
okay.
That was
Brian went to. He went to Oklahoma State as well.
Oh, okay. I know that. Brian Williams as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. But yeah. So it for me, it wasn't as many guys that were around my age that made it to the professional ranks. Other than those names I just listed, but I think from my standpoint, like I can remember like playing against guys in AAU. Like we played against Brandon Knight. Played against Josh Selby. We played against Tim Hardaway. We played against Harrison Barnes. I mean, Xavier Henry. Like, we played against a lot of guys like AAU, and that's why I think AAU it's kind of different now because a lot of guys they switch teams up so often. Where when we were coming through, it was like you were on that one team, and like if you saw that team, you were going to see the same players. Like it wasn't no switch up or, hey, let's play on this team one weekend and then switch up to another team. That's why I enjoyed AAU when I was growing up because the competition level was just, it was through the roof because every team had a pro on it. I mean, not knowing at the time that we were going to be pros, but that's just how it looked from the outside, like looking back now.
How'd you end up going to St. Joe's?
So it's a lot of different moving pieces right here, right?
Yep.
So my uncle was assistant coach at St. Joe's, Jeff Arnold. My mom is actually from Philadelphia as well. So I wanted my grandmother, my aunts and uncles, cousins, all of them to see me play. Phil Martelli, another huge component of that. Like he got Jameer Nelson, Delonte West to the pros. So I was like, hey, look, why not try to get another guard to get to the pros? And then, lastly, just the opportunity to, not saying I wanted to leave Louisiana and play basketball, but every summer I would go back up to Philly and play. I don't know if you remember John Harnett. He used to have, it was basically a pros, like kind of like workouts slash.
Is that the one at LaSalle?
Every summer.
At LaSalle. Yeah, no, right. It's funny because when I was a player, I worked out in that workout, and then I played on a team that went because I'm Jewish, the Maccabi team, and we went to Israel and we trained at LaSalle. I think Bruce Pearl was coaching the team, and I was an assistant, and we practiced at LaSalle. But that workout went on beforehand, and then some of those guys stuck around, and they scrimmaged against them or whatever. So yeah, I know that was an unbelievable group that would work out in Philly. Anyway, so you'd go there every summer, and that's where you would work out.
Yeah. So I mean, I would go over there. Like I was like, it was me and another kid. I can't think of his name right now. It was we were the only two high school kids to even get a chance to play, and so. I held my own the first day, and then they were like, hey, look, we want you to come back. And then I just, you know, day after day, I would hold my own. And so I had a lot of opportunity to play against pros growing up, and I was like, man, it's no point of me going to a school that it's great to stay in Louisiana, great to go to other schools, but I knew I was going to get a chance to play against other pros every single summer. And that was a great opportunity for me to think ahead of the game and not even knowing it while I was doing it.
Okay, so, but you had, even though you had spent time in Philadelphia, you had family in Philadelphia, we'd be kidding ourselves if we didn't say the kind of culture of Philadelphia is very, very different. What was that first freshman year like to be in Philly at St. Joe's playing hoop, but also kind of adjusting to your life?
You know, the one crazy story that I tell everybody that really shocks everybody is that when I got to Philly, my first that was my first winter, my real first winter. I get to campus and it's like 50 degrees outside. And so I'm like, I walk outside, I'm like, oh, it's freezing out here. So I put on like one of my big puff jackets that we just got from the team. And like everybody else is still walking around with shorts and shirt on. Like, I'm like, yep. Man, like, y'all not cold? Like, and everybody's like, man, you tripping. Like, I don't know why you have all the gear on and when it's feels real good out here. So that was my first experience with the winter. And it wasn't even winter yet. It was still just fall. So I was like, man, like, I'm in for a rude awakening, especially when it starts snowing and all that.
Here's my story. So I grew up in Southern California. I went to Notre Dame my first year, and I'll never forget, it was like early October, right? And it was 50 degrees, and I own like one pair of jeans, right? Like, that wasn't, I always wear either hoop sweats or shorts, you know, that was it. And so before I left, and this is in the mid-90s, my mom bought me a parka. And I had like a Orlando Magic starter parka from the Shaq days. And I had this like LL Bean ugly green parka with a hood. And I woke up and I had an early morning workout, like individual workout before practice started, right? And I put on a beanie and I put on my parka and I had my sweats and I rode my bike to the gym. And so I'm walking out and I got all this stuff on. And the coaches call me into the office and they take pictures of me and they're all clowning and laughing at me like, dude, it's 50 degrees outside. What are you doing? This is not, wait 3 months and it's cold. So I know exactly what you're, okay. So, what about playing for Phil? Like, Phil did have a ton of success. Obviously that one incredible team that lost in the Elite Eight and that was undefeated in the regular season. They put guys in the pros. He does seem to let his guards play, but and he's quick with a joke, but what's he has some interesting kind of thoughts on basketball, some that I think really helped you, that I want to get to, but what were your memories of first playing for Phil Martelli? Was it easy? Was it hard? An adjustment? Was he tougher than anyone? Like, what was it really like?
It actually was a pretty easy transition because my high school coach was really good too. Not in the sense of like how he coached, but just, you know, the yelling, the screaming, the running, different things like that. So Coach Martelli was actually a really easy transition for me because he would get on you, but it would be in the sense of like him yelling to like get you in the mindset of, hey, look, this is what you're going to be dealing with through a game. Like, how do you get through a game and how do you understand that? And so, Coach, he has a different philosophy that, you know, I think a lot of guys, they have a tough time with it. But I think from day one, when we all, like, it was basically five, six of us that were freshmen that stepped on campus, we had a mentality about us as like, hey, look, we're going to try to turn this program around. And it was one step at a time. I mean, we started out the first year. I think our end up record was like 11-20 something. It was terrible. It was terrible. But that was our mindset. It was like, hey, how can we get Phil back on the pedestal of, you know, ruling Philadelphia basketball? Because we saw how people treated Phil, and we also didn't want to be treated like that as well. So it kind of just left a bad taste in our mouth. And I think that's the same thing that, you know, Phil has. He has that sense of, man, I want to get back at these guys as bad as I want to, but I got to slowly but surely ease back into it. And so first year had a rough year, and then it kind of just built up where, you know, by my senior year, we ended up winning the A-10 tournament and, you know, Phil's back on top. So that was really the biggest thing for me is, like, we wanted to get Phil back on the pedestal and you know, if he wanted to retire, hey, look, that was on him. But, you know, finish out our careers, especially at St. Joe's and so many other people that wanted us to win, and we end up winning.
So your first year was what, 2010, 2011, I want to say?
Yep, 2010, 2011, yep.
Yeah, and so then as you point out, by your senior year, you guys had a really good team. I mean, I love DeAndre Bembry. That dude could go as well, and Ronald Roberts and yourself, and who's a Jersey cat. Like, so who are you closest to on that team?
You know what? We all are real, real tight. I mean, so we had me, Ronald, and Halil, all three of us, same class. Darius Quills, same class. We had a couple walk-ons that I'm real close with as well. And then DeAndre, you know, DeAndre, and then it's so crazy. Isaiah Miles was on that team as well. Isaiah tried out Sixers a couple times, didn't make it, didn't pan out, but he had really came close to making it. All of us still real close. Me and DeAndre still talk. I mean, we're gonna be brothers for life. I mean, we went through so many battles and so many different things with each other that it really left a bond between all of us.
If you could close your eyes and think back to your senior year, right? Your senior year when you win the A-10, you guys, I mean, like, there were so many ups and so many downs, right? Like, I remember you guys got crushed by Nova by like 30, mm-hmm. right? But then there was some, you know, massive wins. You know, you guys beat VCU kind of later in the year. You guys swept Dayton that year. The NCAA tournament game, which went to overtime, which was an incredible game. What's the most memorable game?
I mean, I would definitely say winning the A-10, but I mean, you know, that's probably, everybody probably would say that. But you know what? My most memorable moment about that year was us losing Nova on Hawk Hill. And after that game, I think our record was like 3-4 or something like that. And I remember we had a meeting the next day. And I pulled.
Okay, so hold on. You lose by 30 on Hawk Hill. It's in your home arena, which of course
lost by 30.
Okay, I got a point. And you lost to Temple the game before. You're 4-4 at the time. This is December.
That's right.
Yep. You got like two games before Christmas break. You got Drexel coming in the next game. So who called the meeting? Did coach call the meeting? Did you call the meeting? Like, who called the meeting?
So we it was basically like a team meeting, just to catch up and just say, hey, look, what do we want to do going forward? And I remember vividly, like, coach not yelling, not doing anything, but just saying, hey, look, it's in your senior's court. What do y'all want to do? Do y'all want to fold over and just say, hey, look, we had a heck of a run and at the end of our careers at St. Joe's, and do y'all want to, you know, turn this around and really make this into a heck of a year? And I remember that day, finished up that day. The next day, me, Ronald, and Halil all went to, I took them out, we went to lunch. We all laid everything on the table and said, hey, look, what do we want to do? What do we want to accomplish? Because at the end of the day, everybody wants to go professional, but like, hey, we got to do it as a collective group. And I'm telling you, with that meeting and the meeting before that, like, literally everything turned around. Our season turned around. We started having fun, and I mean, the rest is history. That game right there, like getting blown out on national TV at home, coach yelling and screaming, like it was a culmination of everything built up. That hey, look, we needed that wake up call to say, hey, look, we need to get going. And I'm telling you, that took everybody's career took off from there.
You guys get to the NCAA tournament, and you drew UConn. What do you remember about the game?
I mean, my only memory which is so crazy, is me missing the shot at the end of the regulation. That's the only memory. I can remember the whole game, but that was my biggest thing. Was like I missed the shot to win it. It might have been like 5 seconds left. I had the ball in my hands. Try to go right baseline, and I thought I had like an angle to bank it off the glass. And literally, like, I might have just barely like move my finger on the ball, and I remember just hitting the side of the backboard and bouncing back to me. Shot clock goes off. There's like 2 seconds left. I'm like sick because I'm like, man, that was my chance to win the game. Like, take us to the next round. I'm having a heck of a game. I think I ended up finishing the game with like 20-some points. But like, I just that's the only memory I can remember. Like, man, I feel like I let the whole team down. Like, I feel like I let just St. Joe's down. That was crazy. That was probably one of my, like, not saying it's the most, like, regrettable moment I've ever had, but it kind of is, though.
It's interesting, though. Like, right, you make that shot. UConn loses. You miss that shot. They win in overtime. They win a national championship. Like, that's how, you know, who knows how history changes on that one shot, and it's crazy.
Yep.
The part that sticks out to me in listening to you talk about it, and I've talked to Phil, there's two things, actually. First is, and this is his coaching philosophy. You know, I was up for a couple coaching jobs, and I said, "What, Phil, what should I do? Like, what should be my game plan if I get one of these jobs?" And he said, "Look, whatever you do, spend time every day having your guys play one-on-one.
Yep.
Have them play, especially in the off season." He goes, "You're going to come in, you can take a job, and you're going to want to show everybody how great your offense is, how smart you are." He's like, "But you know what? Like, you got plenty of time for that. You wear guys out with that. End of the day, you win or lose games based upon your best player having the ball and making a shot. And the more he does it, the greater a chance. And it's an investment in the kid because the kid realizes that it's going to help him take the big shot, but it's also going to help him to get to the next level in that." End of the day, all things being equal, if you can get your own shot, take and make your own shot in a big situation, you're more valuable than the next guy. I thought that was brilliant. I also thought that was because you did get open. It wasn't a bad shot. You just missed it, right? I thought that was like his coaching philosophy coming to bear. Is that accurate for in the offseason he would have you guys play one-on-one a lot?
You know what? He never told us, hey, look, let's go play one-on-one. It was more just us just doing it on our own. And that's what I loved about our coach is, like, he never, like, hey, look, this is mandatory. We're going to play one-on-one today. It was just like, what y'all want to do? And we're like, we want to play one-on-one. We're going to play. Like, that's what it is. Like, that's basketball. And if you're not competitive enough to say, hey, look, this is what I want to do every single day, like, this is what I love to do, like, you're in the wrong sport. So that's why I loved it. I loved every single moment of just, like, everybody on my team was always – I was always the small – not saying I was the smallest guy, but I was one of the smallest guys on my team. So I had to compete against guys 6'7" and above every single day. Like, they guard me, I'm guarding them. Like, it is what it is. And that's what I think it made me into a better player because I had to learn how to score over bigger guys. And also, too – It really shows the cream rise to the top. It shows who the top dog is.
Did you watch the rest of the NCAA tournament? Like, did you even watch UConn beat Kentucky for the national championship?
I didn't watch all the game, like the games. I just watched the highlights because I was just so upset.
Going it's hard, like, right? It's like that should be me.
Yeah. Like, and then I saw them win one game, and then I'm like, all right, well, we would have played Nova, boom, like they beat Nova, man. Then they go ahead, and I think they played Michigan State and then somebody else, and Iowa State or something like that, and they beat them. And I'm like, God, like, now they're going to the Final Four. Like, we had this team beat, and they, like, dominating these teams. And then they go on to beat, Kentucky and Wisconsin or something like that, or whoever it was. And I'm just like, I can't even think who was in the championship game.
No, they beat Kentucky in the championship game. They beat
Kentucky in the championship.
In the semifinal, they beat Florida. They beat Florida.
Florida, that's right, Florida. And I'm just like, man, like, we would have had a chance to make it to the championship. Like, and that was stuck in my head, like, the whole pre-draft. And, like, I remember seeing, I can't think of anything. What was the? Do you remember the shooter's name? He was a foreign shooter on that team.
What's his name from Niels Giffey or whatever, right?
He came to the Portsmouth camp with me, the seniors only They invite the top, I want to say, 60 kids that seniors, and he's there, and I'm like looking at him, and I'm like, we should have beat y'all, like individually, like we would have beat them, but like as a collective group, they had a heck of a group because they had it was all spread around. They had shot blockers, they had scorers, they had facilitated. I mean, their team was well rounded, and we were just a small mid-major school just trying to make some noise. And I mean, just I feel like just, you know, one half a meter over, I would have banked it in and we would have won that game. But hey, I guess life works its way out. And look, I'm about to be 7 years in the NBA, and everything else is history.
You know, it's interesting. I think you had more pros than they did, right? You and DeAndre. That's, you know, and Halil.
Yeah, yeah. Me
still
and DeAndre.
Well,
and they only had Shabazz. That was the only one that went pro.
Yeah, and you've had a better pro career than Shabazz has. The part that jumps out to me is, and I feel this way about my school, but I didn't make the NBA. You know, I played overseas. Is that I feel like we do this thing in the media where we make college basketball only about being a kind of stopping point on the way to the NBA, and we don't realize all the other things that guys get out of it. And to me, it's this, there is this aspect of playing for, like you said, when you missed that shot, it wasn't that you felt like you let you down. You let your coach, your teammates, your school, like St. Joe, like it's a real thing that you're a part of something kind of bigger than yourself. And yeah. I could be wrong. Again, I've never played in the NBA. And I do think that at the end, when you get to the end of the championship, if you're in the finals, like, yeah, there is, and especially now guys in the bubble, there's probably much better team chemistry than normally. But it's not the same. Like, having played now 7 years in the NBA, is there anything close to the feeling of being a part of a team like it was in college?
You won't get the same, I guess you say, like, just, I won't say naive, but I'll say, like, just blind to the fact of just saying, hey, look, it's pure. Basketball is pure when it's not about money. And when you get to the professional ranks, when money's involved and a lot of, like, ego and a lot of other things are involved, that kind of changes things. But I will say there's a few teams I've seen in the bubble that I can tell that they've thrown their egos out the window and they're just out there playing. Like Toronto, for example, they're out there just playing. Like, it doesn't matter who's a free agent. Like Fred VanVleet is a free agent, and he doesn't even care. Like, he's just out there playing and having a good time. But he's playing well, but, like, at the same time, too, he's just out there playing. I mean, I'm sure there's other guys on the team that are free agents, but it's like he's one of the guys that stands out. Another team is OKC. Like, they're playing well, but it's like the Rockets are just a better team. And they're partner, you know, the Rockets, they're going to keep battling between the two because both of them want to win. But it's like, let's see what tonight holds. But it's just like those are the instances where when you have a team just playing and not thinking out there, they're dangerous. They're dangerous, and that's when you can kind of see upsets and whatnot in the NBA ranks. But for the most part, when like I said, when the money and egos and all that become a factor, like I've seen tons of teams that I've been on that came in a factor. And we struggle. We struggle throughout the year. Like, guys get to free agency break or all-star break, and guys are only thinking about, well, am I about to get traded? Am I having a good enough year where do I need to sit out? Some guys say, hey, look, I'm trying not to get injured, so let me just ease my way through it. Like, it's a lot of different factors.
When did you? I mean, I'm sure always been a shoe guy, but what was the first kind of creative shoe you decided to wear?
My first creative shoe, I probably would go all the way back to when I was like, 13, 14, and my dad would always bet me. He was like, if you win a championship or something like that, he'll buy me a brand new pair of shoes, which was a basketball shoe, and that's all I would get for a whole year. I would only have one pair of shoes for the whole season. And so every year I would win something along the way or win some award or something. And he would always say, hey, look, you get a chance to pick whatever shoe you want. And I would always go on Nike ID, or if we were Adidas team, I would go on Adidas and I would customize a pair of shoes like the Nike ID or Adidas ID. And then say, hey, look, here's my shoe. I had to wait, 3 to 6 weeks till it came in. Once it came in, then I'm like, all right, I'm rocking this for the rest of the year. And so that's probably my first inclination of like, all right, I like customizing shoes. It's different. And you get to put your own spin on it. And so that was probably like my biggest, like, just goal as a kid is like, hey, look, how can I be different than everybody else? Because everybody else is going to wear the same pair of shoes, but how can I be different?
Yeah. So you go undrafted. How did you come to pick the Nets for Summer League? I mean, the Knicks, excuse me, for Summer League.
Me and my agent, we had a long conversation going undrafted. We knew it was a possibility that probably was going to happen just because I played 4 years, and that's the, I guess you say, the new morale. Is like, hey, look, you're a senior, you're too old. And so we looked at all the teams. We came down to, like, it was like a couple of teams that I had a choice between. And we thought that, hey, the Knicks probably had the best chance of me possibly sneaking in the roster. And, you know, as an undrafted guy, I'm just trying to get a chance to show myself. As a brand new coach coming in, we had Derek Fisher coming in, brand new regime coming in, Phil's the president. And so I'm like, all right, well, this might be a chance for me to kind of learn about this triangle offense as well as get my name out there. And so I really wasn't worried about, like just – I wasn't nervous. I would say that. I wasn't nervous. I just was out there just playing, just having a good time. And, I mean, it's just the same thing that we just talked about, like, one-on-one. Like, I'm out there playing – one day I'm JR, the next day Shump, the next day I'm playing Melo. Like, every single day was a competition for me because I'm playing against dudes that I grew up watching. Like, I'm watching them on TV, like – now I'm getting a chance to play against them. So I'm like, well, I'm trying to bust them up. Like, I don't want them to bust me up. Like, I want to go out there and showcase, hey, look, I'm here, and I want to showcase that I want to stay. And so as, like, the preseason and all that kind of went on, and then we got into me playing with them in Summer League, I was like, hey, look, this might be the great opportunity for me to go out there, play against some other older guys in Summer League, and then see where I'm at from there and see how the chips fall. And Play well. I mean, the first game I was absolutely nervous in Summer League, and then my second game played really well, and then from then on, I never looked back.
So you get done with Summer League, but, you know, when you play in Summer League, you're not necessarily under contract with the Knicks or to play for the Westchester team. You get done. How long was the process before you decided to sign with the Knicks and play for Westchester?
So I remember getting cut on I think it was like a Friday. Maybe, no, you know what? I think it was a Monday. I got waived on a Monday from the roster. One of my other good friends, he ended up making the roster. I didn't make it. I was the last two cut. So it was only two of us left, and I was the one to get cut. And so I went from there getting cut to having a week off to figure out if I wanted to go play overseas, or did I want to be an affiliate player for the Westchester Knicks, which was a brand new team that was just getting started. And so my whole thing was, I can go out and chase the money and play overseas and that'd be it, or I could stay. I wasn't married at the time. I didn't have a kid at the time. I just was out there just ready to play. And so that's why I was like, well, let me just stay here in the United States and see what I can kind of draw up and just play. And so getting the opportunity to go to the G League, well, D League at the time, G League now, and really work on my skills, it really helped me out in the long run, because I was able to work on not just like my shooting or anything like that, but like my ball handling, my defense, my work ethic really changed because I had a lot of guys around me that were working hard, so I had to work even harder. So it really helped me along the way because mentally I wasn't ready, but it got me ready. It got me ready, that's for sure.
So when did you get the call? What was the call up for the 10-day? What was that like?
So the 10-day, January 7th, I'm actually sitting in the room with my roommate, Orlando Sanchez, and we're actually playing video games. And
what game?
Remember, I'm like,
what game?
Which F?
What game were you playing?
I think we're playing 2K. We had just, I think we had just got done with practice, and then, the week leading up into it, like, everybody was, like, already on my mind, like, man, I'm telling you, you're going to get called up. I'm just like, man, look, January 7th comes. If I get called up, I get called up. January 7th hits. Nothing goes on the whole, like, afternoon. I'm just, you know, went to practice, came back home, relaxed at this point. Next thing you know, like, we're playing 2K. Get a call on my phone. Answer it. Hey, it's Allen Houston. Just want to let you know the Knicks are going to call you up, and you're going to be the first ever call up for the Westchester Knicks, going to the Knicks. And I was like, wow, like, so what's next? And he's like, well, look, I'm going to send you a car. It should be waiting outside for you in the next 5 minutes. You get in the car, head to Penn Station downtown, and then head on to D.C. because you got to play the Washington Wizards tomorrow. And I was like, oh, shoot, like, I got to go right now. Like, it's time to play. And I remember I didn't get in until about, like, 2, 3 in the morning. Tired as can be. But it's like, hey, look, my dream is here. I can't be tired now. So I literally was ready to go. I just mentally exhausted, but I was just like, I don't have no time to rest now. I gotta really take my game to a whole other level to get where I need to be at, to make sure I stay here for this first 10-day contract.
So the next day, did you have shoot around the day of the game, or is it just you show up at the game?
No. Yeah. So we had shoot around the next day. We go down to the arena. We shoot around. Then we leave, shoot around, head back to hotel. We have team meal, go from team meal, go upstairs, take a little nap. And then it's so crazy because my routine back then was always riding on the first bus, getting there early, get my shots up and getting ready for the game. And it still is the same today. Like, I haven't changed that, where I always want to be the first one on the court, first one to work out, get my sweat and get ready to play. And so, back then, it was mandatory. I had to be the first one on the court because if not, everybody else had their times already slotted out, especially because I'm just getting onto the team. Everybody else is already ready to go. So we get to the arena early. I work out, feeling great. Everybody around me was, like, really encouraging. They was like, hey, look, this opportunity, man. Go out there and get it, man. We know what you can do. Just go do it. Coach Fisher, he's the same way. Hey, look, young fella, just relax. Go out there, have some fun tonight. And I'm like, all right, cool. And
What's that like the first time you're sitting down there? You're sitting down there. You're on the bench. You're in Washington, and you played a bunch. And you know, I'll get to your second. You had 19. Your second game against Houston. But your first game, you're playing against the Wizards. I mean, what's that feeling like to where Fish comes down and points to you and says you're in? Like, that's got to be a bit of a big moment.
Yeah, and I can remember that moment vividly. It's like I was just sitting there because I was sitting. I was right close to the top of the bench. I was talking to one of the other assistant coaches because he was telling me, like, making sure I knew the plays and making sure I knew everything. But the triangle is pretty simple. I mean, it's not simple in the stance of you have to mentally understand where to go when, you know, if something's taken away, you got to go the opposite way. So
right.
I was already.
It's all based upon where there's set movement based upon where the ball is and where the two pass goes versus the three pass goes. And
exactly.
Right. But it sets up perfectly to your game because there's really good spacing. You don't have to be like a true point guard. There's no ball screens. But if you can get your own shot or play off somebody else's penetration, you can really play.
You can really play, yeah. And it's all about just having other intelligent people around you. Everybody has to have a high IQ to understand how to make the ball pop and move around. I think that I was definitely nervous. I won't lie. I was very nervous going into the game. And then I got my first, I think I got a steal, something like that, and took it to the basket, got fouled, made my first free throw, and everything kind of relaxed after that. I mean,
So the next game, though, is the following day, you go back and you play in the Garden. You're like, there's the NBA, and then there's I'm playing for the Knicks in the Garden. And you drop 19 and hit three threes in your first game in the Garden. What was that experience like?
Yeah, I really just was there. And it's so crazy to say that, but it's like I didn't expect myself to do anything like that. I just was out there just playing. And lo and behold, we were getting blown out. Like, don't forget to mention that. Like, we were playing the Rockets. I get a couple of people before the game, before we go out there. And my boys are all telling me, man, don't get crossed up, man. Don't let Harden cross you up, this and that. And I'm just like, man, look, I'm not. That's the last thing on my mind right now. I'm just trying to make sure I don't embarrass myself out here and play terrible. And so I remember I just went out there and just played. And we started getting blown out. We're down by like 20. The crowd starts booing. And the next thing you know, I come in the game. I hit a couple shots. The crowd starts getting into the game. Like, I mean, not saying we're coming back and like that, but they just get into the game because I'm playing well and playing hard. I got a tip slam dunk, and like the crowd gets on their feet, and teammates are getting on their feet, and it's a whole different atmosphere then. So I'm like, wow, like this. I think I'm here, and like it's almost like I've arrived type moment. Like, man, like if this is what it's gonna be like. Like, I want to, you know, feel this every. I want to be in this moment all the time. I don't want this just to be one time moment. I want this to happen to me more so often. And so it literally just took me from being a kid again. Like, I was like, I felt like I was a kid again, just out there in the backyard hooping, like counting down 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, you know, Kobe, Jordan, whatever, and shoot my shot. So that's how I felt.
All right, you did. I mean, the contract with Detroit was that's like a legit 3-year big time deal. And I know you played in New Orleans. You got to go back and play relatively kind of your hometown. That had to be amazing. But to sign the deal you signed with Detroit, considering, you know, you weren't a top 20 recruit, and though you had a very good college career, you weren't drafted. You had to go through the G League. You chose to, you know, bet on yourself and stay here instead of going overseas. Take me through that moment of signing the big deal with Detroit.
Yeah, my agent, I will give him a lot of credit, Michael Siegel. He did a lot of work for me to get that deal, and so going it really led up into me getting traded to Sacramento. I actually had one more year on my contract. It was a two year deal I had in New Orleans. But it was the second year with a player option. And so leading up until the end of the Sacramento season, we've been going back and forth with the management group over in Sacramento and saying the direction they were heading. And then, lo and behold, Detroit ended up coming in the last minute and saying, hey, look, we want you to come and play for us. And that was the Stan Van Gundy era. And I was like, man, like, you know, if a team wants me, that's a great sign. Like that, I mean, they're gonna let me really rock out and let me play. Because at that point in my career, it was a lot of ups and downs. Like after getting traded, like my mental, everything was kind of just all screwed up. But then having that moment of like, hey, look, somebody wants you. Like Detroit really wants you for 3 years. Like, it really changed my whole mindset and the scope. But, I mean, the business side, yes, I understood that. That made me understand getting traded and treating the game as a business as well as a kid's game as well. Like, it really opened my eyes to a lot of different things. But also, too, it really helped me because I knew that, like I said, it gave me a lot of confidence to go into my first year in Detroit. Like, hey, look, I think I can make some noise with signing this contract now. And I've changed a lot of, like, the stereotypes for myself, because if I go out here and make the most out of this contract, I can sign something even bigger than that and really put my name and put my, you know, my family on my back.
Toughest dude to cover in the NBA is who? For you?
I probably would say toughest has been Kyrie. I enjoy playing against Kyrie. But yeah, I'm always like, it's always gonna be a battle. I'm always, you know, going back and forth with him, scoring a bucket, talking, like, it's a lot of like whispering and he's real shifty. So I love competing against him and going after him. So it's always a good matchup.
He's a bad boy, right? Like, he can just, I mean, the finishing shots are unreal. The handle is unreal. The creativity is ridiculous as well. Best teammate you've had in the NBA?
You know, that's so hard to say. I'm gonna say that there's been a lot of great teammates along the way. So I don't want to specifically name one, because I know there's been so many and I don't want to miss anybody. So I've had a lot of great ones over my career.
What's it like to be on the same court as LeBron?
It's just like any other player. Like, he does. I mean, I will say this: he does. He sees things before other guys see them. So I will say his IQ, his passing ability, his eye for the game is at a whole nother level than everybody else's. So, I give him a lot of credit, because, you know, he studies a lot and it just comes with the game. Like, he's been in that spotlight for so long that he just knows how to play. He knows how to entertain. He knows how to entertain for sure.
You mentioned playing a video game, 2K, the first time you got the call for the 10-day. I mean, have you thought, you have your own shoe, your own Q4 shoe, right? You have a guaranteed contract. You played 7 years in the NBA. Now you're on 2K, right? Now you can play yourself. Right?
Yep.
Do you ever have a chance to have that perspective of, wow, I've really, really made it? Like, even if you never make an all-star team, you've accomplished more than 99.999% of basketball players ever even dream of accomplishing.
I never had that chance to just sit back and just blah and just be in awe, because I'm still in the moment. I will say I've had the chance to just play against other people as my creative player on 2K. Yeah. I mean, that's just great, because everybody's like, man, you get to play as yourself. Who are you going to play with? I'm like, man, I'm playing with myself. Like, what are you talking about? Like, that's no homo, man. I'm just like saying, like, that's a dream, like, to play as your own creative player on the game, and then to really be in the game and play against yourself. Like, that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. So I will say that, like, it is a dream come true to play a video game as myself. But yeah, now I'm so, like, locked into the moment that I think I won't appreciate it until later on, once my career is all said and done, and I'm able to, like, look back at it with my son or something like that when he gets old enough to understand what's going on.
If you could tell a high school kid, hey, here's how you might not make it, but here's how you give yourself the best chance of making it, what would your advice be?
My advice to myself right now and to this day is, it's been sacrifice. How can you sacrifice time with your family, time hanging out with your friends, and time sleeping and everything like that? How can you sacrifice all that to make it to where you want to make it to? And I've had to do that along this journey. And so I'll say it to any high school kid now. It's like, if you really want this to be something you want to do in the future, like, you want basketball to be your job, you have to sacrifice a lot to get to this point. And it's not going to be given to you. That's for sure. Unless, like, just, you know, you have a God-given ability, and it's just, you're coasting in LeBron or something like that. But still, you still have to work every single day and sacrifice so much to get to that point. And like everybody says, like, it's only a small, slim chance that you make it, but it's like, that's going to give you the best shot, just sacrificing and putting in a lot of hard work, putting in a lot of hard work.
Langston, man, listen, it's been awesome to see you grow as a player, and great to catch up with you. Love to have you on the radio show in very, very near future. In the meantime, enjoy that time with your son, watching guys hoop, and can't wait to see you back on an NBA floor next season. Thanks for being our guest on All Ball.
Thank you so much.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
All right, let me give you a couple quick thoughts on the Lakers as they will get back to playing. And as we told you, Portland wasn't a tough matchup for them. And now Damian Lillard's gone home, so eventually they'll play this game five and the series will in fact be over. They're going to win based upon their defense. And if they just get enough scoring from guys, you know, not named LeBron and not named Anthony Davis, and really Anthony Davis, if he can show the ability to score in the fourth quarter, that's huge. But the plan for this team, right, the blueprint for this team was 75 points between Kuzma, LeBron, AD. And Kuzma sometimes has and sometimes has not provided his end of the bargain. And then the rest of the team just pick it up, play defense, and hit enough shots to keep everybody out of the lane for LeBron and for Anthony Davis. That's how they play. Like, they maul you defensively. They're the best defensive team in the West, and that's kind of their path to a championship. So I think they played to their blueprint quite well, whereas the Clippers are still trying to figure out exactly who they are and what they are. Do they have pieces that tell you they should be a great defensive team? Yes. Are they a great defensive team? At times. And I think Paul George making shots makes Paul George play better defensively, makes the whole thing work, and that's why they scored 159 points the last time out. The Clippers have more top-to-bottom talent. They have more weapons to score, but sometimes it's just about knowing who you are, and the Clippers don't seem to know that just yet. All right, Langston Galloway was great. Obviously, this is an interesting time in the NBA. I'm happy they're coming back and playing. It sucks, frankly, as an American, that this is, you know, how I think we're viewed in the world, that we just cannot seem to figure out our issues. And I would like NBA players, like, look, you definitely have power and influence, to have reasonable goals and expectations, demand them of our leadership, and stick to those demands. Right? Like, look, we're not going to defend the police. And at times you can't speed up investigations, or mistakes are made, and the legal system is kind of what it is. But you have every right to demand justice for all citizens, not just black ones that are unarmed and shot in the back. I mean, for anybody. But I think that the next step, and the way in which you've gotten everybody's attention, is good, is peaceful protest. Not going to play today. Now we get back to work, but we want to demand change. Here's some smart things that we feel like can change and helped shift us towards moving forward instead of remarking on actions that have taken place. All right, feel free to tweet at me at Gottlieb Show. You can be up on our Facebook page, the Doug Gottlieb Show Facebook page. Some of you slide into my IGs and make comments anyway. We'll put this out on IG. In the meantime, appreciate you downloading, subscribing, and listening. I got a bunch of thoughts for you on college basketball in the bubble. I got great guests coming up for you. Keep listening to All Ball.